Good morning, members. We'd like to convene the House Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Committee together. Today, we're going to continue on some game and fish issues. The DNR is going to present their bill. We will not be acting on the bill today. There's a few other game and fish bills that different members are working on, and we'll be bringing that back at a later date to move the bill. Mr. Meyer, are you going to lead off here and then move into
Mr. some of Chair, the... Mr. Chair, yes, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. We do have to start with I think about four different one- or two-page documents, follow-up from our last hearing, that Kathy Don Carlos, Deputy Director from Division of Fish and Wildlife, and Steve Merchant will be going over. But as we're looking at the game and fish language, we do have an author's amendment that we're working on. So Kathy will probably just say this is a section we're going to be working on some language for. So rather than present that amendment at this time, we're working on some tweaks to the bill. Things are a little bit out of sequence on this one, but since it's just going to be laid over, I understand our intention would be to have that rolled out at the time, or maybe just amend the language as it comes forward the next time.
And Mr. Meyer, just to clarify, members, we only have draft language, I believe, at this time on the bill. I think it's safe to say that Representative Hackbart is going to be carrying the bill again. He carried the Game and Fish bill last year, but we're working with the agency as they work through and with the administration to get the bill moving forward. And we're going to have the same issue tomorrow on the AIS issue. We're not going to have the bill in the form we'd like to see it, but we will be moving the discussion forward because some of this stuff is timely, and as some of it's going to be a case of where we ask for additional information, give the agency time to bring it forward, both in the issue of game and fish and AIS tomorrow. So proceed, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I'll bring up Kathy and Pete.
Welcome, Deputy Director. If you could identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning. My name is Kathy Don Carlos. I'm Deputy Director for the DNR's Division of Fish and Wildlife.
And I'm Steve Merchant, the Wildlife Population Program Manager with the Section of Wildlife.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we're really glad to be back this morning to do two things. Chairman indicated, we're here to follow up on some questions that came up in our discussion on January 26th at your hearing last week. And secondly, we're also here to present a briefing on the Game and Fish Policy Bill this year. So we'd like to start with some of the questions that came up from last week. We went back with a list of questions that you had. You did ask about a deer population update. You asked for a moose population update for both the northwest part of the state and the northeast. You requested information about a deer study that we're conducting in the northwest in the area of the former bovine TB zone. And I think those were the three main areas. And you also had a question about wolf budgets, wolf management budgets. So Chair and committee members will start with answering those questions from last week. And I'd like to turn it over to Steve Merchant to walk us through each of the questions.
Welcome, Mr. Merchant. You can continue. I believe you've already introduced yourself, so go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. First, I could walk you through the document that's titled the 2012 Deer Population Goal Setting. Beginning in 2005, we had a deer population goal setting process that included the public for the first time. The outcome of that process was that nearly one half of the permit areas across the state were slated for a deer population reduction, and conversely, 40% of the areas our plan was to increase the deer population. If you turn your page and look at the figure on page 2, that is a graphic representation of the results of those. The permit areas that are in red are those permit areas where the original public input process resulted in deer population reductions. And the green, the darker green, are areas of the state where we wanted to grow the deer population. The current status of those populations are exhibited in that the graphic on the following page, where you can see the permit areas that are now in the yellow are at goal. The permit areas in red are still above goal, and the areas in green are below goal. So I think it, as far as numbers go, nearly 70% of the permit areas are now within the goal, and just 15% are below goal. 18% of the areas remain above goal. We're planning to initiate a similar process sometime late this winter to reassess these population objectives. We'll hopefully have information from that process to inform our decision-making regarding the 2012 hunt. But it's unlikely that we'll have the entire state completed at that time. Our top priority is to do work in the southwest Minnesota, and we'll likely do some work in the southeast as well as portions of the northern forest. If you turn to the back of that document, you can see what our 2011 actual numbers of pre-fawn deer densities are by those permit areas. The light sort of Caribbean blue or green are low deer density areas, where the darker the blue, the higher the deer population.
Questions? Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I note as we're trying to raise the populations in some areas that the Deer Hunters Association testified in support of the program where wolves take livestock and...
Representative Wagenius, excuse me. I do have new hearing aids, but I still am not quite able to hear you.
Ollie,
so if you
I'm
could
working hard.
And they're working fairly well, I thought. So if you could put your mic down. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll try this again. The Deer Hunters Association testified in favor of the notion that we have that where wolves take livestock, that the owner should be reimbursed. Now that you're raising the deer population in some areas, deer don't take livestock, but they certainly do take orchards and things like that. Are you coming out now to use the same logical reasoning to have folks whose property has been taken by deer to reimburse them?
Mr. Merchant.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, we're certainly not suggesting a compensation program for deer damage. What I can tell you is those areas where in the southwest corner of the state where the objective was to raise a deer populations, relatively speaking, the deer populations in that part of the state are still quite low, and the reason that they are low is because we need to balance that concern of those depredation issues that would occur in that part of the state with higher deer populations. We also certainly work with landowners to come up with solutions to those depredation problems, and we provide cost sharing and technical assistance to build fences and those kind of things, but we don't directly compensate landowners.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, I'm looking at this green area, and it's quite large, and deer do take quite a bit. I mean, this is, since this is a goal of the state, and the state is promoting this, and we're working on it, I don't see why it's fair to help one group of people because it's wolves, but not help another group of people because it's deer who are doing the damage. It's just not making sense to me. So I think we need some sort of better logical basis for what we're doing. Do you have any logic here? I mean, or is it just tradition?
Director Don Carlos or Mr. Merchant, any comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, there certainly are traditions associated with what gets compensated and what doesn't. We live in a state with bountiful natural resources, and we strive to find those population levels of game species that meet social acceptance, so that meet social carrying capacity. And we work throughout the state with cities in managing deer populations and goose populations. And I think that it's in Minnesota, it's understood that one cannot live in the state and not be not only benefited by the rich natural resources, but perhaps at times negatively impacted. So I think that's really a social question. We strive for all of the species we manage to find. We can easily determine biological carrying capacity. Social carrying capacity is fluctuating, and it depends. It changes over time, and it changes based on impacts that communities and individuals are seeing. So it's a big issue. It's a big question. I can't speak to why the depredation program, the compensation program for wolves or elk or other species look as they do. But I do think that there are times when species do significantly impact individual landowners. And I think that what we have done up to this point is fair, but we'd be glad to continue to peel that back and come back and talk in the future if that's desirable.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you for allowing a follow-up. Well, it's just not... people who have an orchard, for example, and the, how in the world you manage. So we're discouraging anybody from having orchards or growing fruit because deer are just devastating. But the other issue is that if a deer hits your car and you have a $500 deductible, you, Minnesotan, are paying that $500 deductible, and we know that those costs are enormous. So I guess if you're asking us to accept that social cost for having deer, I just don't know why we would then reimburse people because it's a wolf or because it's an elk. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Representative Wagenius, a couple of things, and where you raised a good question about folks like in the orchard or nursery business don't get compensated from the DNR, and they do not. The DNR does offer opportunities for liberal taking of the deer for those folks if they show damage and have done that outside the regular season in certain situations. And I will say it's easier to take deer than it is to take a wolf, so it is an opportunity. But where you raise the question, and it's hard, in the green area, some of us would argue that this state should be a lot greener than it shows. There's areas of the state that the DNR shows as red and yellow, and I would argue that they should be green. We're below the population goals that a lot of people want, so this is a tough issue and one that has both sides, but I would adamantly say that we're way, way below the goals we should be at, and as far as I'm concerned, we're too worried about the price of car insurance, and we should be more worried about the deer population should be larger, I believe, in a number of parts of the state, and I certainly have heard that over and over. So, but thank you for your Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If that is going to be our policy, and I can hear the rationale for that policy, then it seems to me we cannot pay people because some animal was taken on a farm by a wolf. It just is not fair. I mean, it's a very inconsistent policy. So that's kind of what's good for the goose is what's good for the gander type thing.
Well, you make a good point, and maybe if we get one thing that we should remember is the hunting revenue is very significant, and maybe there's a role that could play going forward because, one, they have certainly showed they're willing to open their pocketbooks up in regards to deer population, and if they're the reason for this, we should have honest discussion about that. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was on the impacts, specifically the car collisions. And you mentioned that you're involving stakeholders. Does the DNR involve, how broad is the stakeholder group? Are you looking at collision data? And are you involving folks from either the repair business or the insurance business, or perhaps, I mean, I think we do have usually a fatality or two a year. Looking at that information in terms of collision incidents and when you're setting population goals.
Director Don Carlos.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's an excellent question, and the deer goal setting process that we used from 2005 to 2007 included a diverse group of stakeholders from clusters of permit areas. And so they weren't just deer hunters, but we had local growers, we had local business people. It was a very diverse group. And one of the things that this process was successful at was this communication between stakeholder interests about their interests and values regarding deer populations. So those discussions about local impact through vehicle collisions definitely came up in all of the discussions that I facilitated. So it was definitely a consideration. There is not one right answer in what should the deer population be for an area. It has to be determined by considering all of the interests and values for stakeholders in that area. Just as when we work with local units of government here in the metro area on deer populations, these things were all considered by the groups as we went outstate with this deer goal setting process.
Representative Hans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the insurance industry does have very detailed information as to collision locations over time. That might be data that you could look at. You know, just like when you're hunting, if you haven't got a deer for the last couple of years, there's a problem with the deer population. If you haven't hit one with a car, there's not a problem until you hit one or two. Or three. And so I think, you know, we have 5 million people in the state now. And as we build into other areas where there was a high deer population, we have more potential for contact, both with the camera, but with the car as well. So I think there's data out there, Mr. Chair, and I think that'd be valuable to take that data in when you're looking at the scientific assessment as to what the population should be. So, and if you need some contacts, I could provide you with some.
Thank you. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Merchant, you know, looking through these, Area 343, where we had the CWD, there is, I guess, a surprise, is what I was told by some of the DNR personnel, at the quantity of deer in that area compared to what they were expecting. And I was wondering if, when you run into, you know, the TB or CWD, and you do a more extensive aerial and population analysis, have you adjusted any of your methodologies for projections of deer population due to these? My understanding is that they knew almost exactly how many deer were in there from that CWD activity. And if you could expound a little bit on, you know, how you update and improve with what you learn.
Mr. Merchant?
Mr. Chair, representative members, yes, in fact, we do validate the population model, if you will, by using other methodologies to assess the deer population. We don't do that annually for every permit area. It would be cost prohibitive to do that, but we do do aerial flights where we count deer. We also use some use a sightability index with some ground observations. So we are using other methods to compare deer densities to what our model would indicate, and those are used to correct for that model. Yes, sir.
Follow-up, Representative Palm.
Actually, just one comment, Mr. Chair. My father loses crops. My mother takes damage to her shrubs and plants. However, they both feel they have just compensation when they eat that venison.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Question for Mr. Merchant. I live in the west central part of the state, and I think talking with hunters and driving around the roads and observing, our deer numbers are down. We also have a beautiful state park in the area, Glacial Lake State Park, and it used to be they'd have a season every 7 or 8 years, but the last few years there's been a season every year. I'm just wondering why, if we're trying to increase the population in that part of the state, why open up the state parks to hunting seemingly on a more regular basis if we're trying to increase the population?
Mr. Merchant or Director Carlos? Mr. Merchant.
Mr. Chair, representative members, I cannot address specifically the issue at the state park. I will say, in general, state parks often act as deer refuges in that part of the state, so they tend to concentrate large numbers of deer, particularly in the winter and during difficult winters. That number of deer can cause some damage to the park and things like forest regeneration and effects on native plant communities. I suspect, but I don't know for sure, that some of those effects are still occurring within the state park, and that's why they continue to hunt them.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Merchant and Ms. Don Carlos, thank you for your presentation today. I'm curious, are the population goals published anywhere? I don't see the actual, you know, physical goal per management area. So that would be a question. And, you know, I have met with you about the landowner problems in southeast Minnesota. We've got, as a matter of fact, some of your staff, the depredation folks, came down to Winona last Thursday, and I appreciate the effort that they put forward. We had about 60 or 70 landowners there that were very frustrated with the thousands of dollars of crop damage that they are suffering at the hands of deer. And members, I really believe we need to work to find additional ways, tools, for landowners to be able to control that damage. I don't think the answer is for us to develop a pot of money at the state legislature or at the state level and be dishing that out for obvious reasons. But we can find ways to empower these landowners in certain situations where the DNR validates their ability to do so, given the deer population levels. Because we've got some of these areas, 345, I think it is, in southeast, which is was a hunter's choice area, or was it 344? I don't know which one of those two. So that means it's a little bit lower than in population than the areas around them. But there are areas within there where there are very high densities that farmers are experiencing. So we really have to find some more tools for these folks. And then one last comment, the 343 area that Representative Quam talked about. Again, we might have the same thing, and I have a hard time believing that that's at goal. I would think it might be actually still over goal. A friend of mine that hunts in that area hunts with a party, shot 10 deer this year. So those are just some anecdotal things. But thank you for your efforts. I hope we can continue to move forward and develop more tools for those landowners to manage those things on their own in ways that don't incur expenses of the state. But lastly, again, the question is, Do we have actual population targets printed for these areas? I'd be interested.
Mr. Merton.
Mr. Chair, or Representative Draskowski, yes, we do. And somewhere in my briefcase I have those. And we have it in a published report, or in a report, and if you would like that, we could certainly get that to you.
Thank you. Representative Draskowski, I had asked late last night, so it was not possible to get here today, some data for over like the last 5 years for both antlered and antlerless deer harvest information and goals and such, so we could look at a comparison statewide. Some of the actual permit numbers have changed boundaries, specifically down in your area with the CWD area, so exact comparisons won't be perfect, but the department has said they'll compile that. Representative Draskowski, I believe this information is on the website, and Director Don Carlos, is it actually even in the colored format and such, so it's easy to follow and look at?
Mr. Chair, yes, all of the information is on the website. We don't have the 2011 season updated on the website yet, but we're currently reviewing the data as it's coming in, and we'll have that information up as soon as possible. I've also made a note, and we'll make sure to get back to you with deer harvest, deer population goals by permit area, harvest and success rate in the next day or two.
Director Don Carlos, that's plenty soon enough. It's going to be a little while before we come back with this bill, but I would like give members a chance to digest it. But again, I would like the information both antlerless and antlered deer, because I believe the department has been over harvesting in some areas with antlerless deer, and I'd like to hear how you arrive at some of the target information. Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen was right that the insurance companies have detailed information about just about everything. I think the piece of information that would be helpful for us to have, for you to get for us from the insurance industry, is how many accidents, or what are you going to call it, accidents there were, say, in a given year, last year or the year before, with deer. What was the total cost to the industry, to insurance, to pay for fixing up those cars? And then very specifically, how many people paid out of pocket, and what was the total cost of deductibles paid by Minnesotans in that same year? Thank you.
Thank you. I think Representative Wiginius, and when we bring the Game and Fish Bill back, why don't we reach out to insurance industry and see if they would like to testify. I think that's a good idea. Representative Purcell.
Good Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a comment. We've been listening to the conversation, and nobody likes deer meat more than me. And I respect what you said, Representative Quam, about we get paid back when we eat deer meat. That's true. But you know, there was a young fellow in my district, a tribal conservation officer, about 12 years ago, he was killed. Deer come through his windshield. And I think we just need to recognize what we're doing here in managing populations to be what we want. We want numbers. We can go out and shoot them. People are going to get killed. People are going to get killed. You got to have respect for that life. Either respect life or you don't. So let's keep that in mind as we're managing here in our wildlife population. That the more deer we have, the higher speed limits we have, we keep pushing speed limits up, the more dead people we're going to have. Let's remember that. I mean, we're supposed to be managing here in some kind of a something to make sense. Can't pick and choose. We got to try and make sense of it. I knew that young fella. Staples was his last name. 26, 27 years old. I'm sure all of you know somebody that had a serious accident with a deer. A deer went out and hit my wife's car. She didn't hit the deer. The deer ran into the side of her car last year. 2 miles from home. It's serious stuff. People's lives. Let's don't get too capricious about it. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Director Don Carlos, do you want to move now into the moose area?
Mr. Chair, we certainly can. We also have a quick briefing on the Northwest deer question, but we'll hold on that and go to moose.
Now, what, Director Don Carlos, good ideas. Keep with the deer for now. Go ahead.
Okay, so we'd like to just briefly, Mr. Chair, answer, I believe it was Representative...
Fabian.
I'm sorry. I know that.
There's only 201 legislators, Assistant Director.
You Representative can't Fabian's great. Question. I did not forget right. The question. I may have just blipped here on the name. We do have a four-page summary on the study that we started last year to better understand movement of deer in, around the bovine, the former bovine TB zone. This is an area where the transition zone meets the ag zone, and the purpose of the study is to better understand movements. In the course of that study, we did radio collar a number of deer, and we experienced a level of mortality that was higher than we anticipated. I'd like to ask my colleague, Mr. Merchant, to go into more detail on what we do know and how this study is a bit unusual.
Mr. Merchant.
Mr. Chair, members, last winter in the months of January and then in March, we captured deer and radio collared deer in the area of the TB zone. In the month of January, we captured 21 deer, and as of January 26th of this year, 8 of those 21 deer have been preyed upon by wolves. That's 38% of that cohort of the animals that were radio collared in March of last year. There were 5 of those animals, and 1 of those had been preyed upon wolves. So 20% of the March captured deer have been preyed upon by wolves. So excuse me, the 8 out of the 21, or the 38%, is the total for both of those cohorts. 44% of the wolves that were captured in January were preyed upon by wolves. That level of mortality certainly is higher than what some of our long-term deer-wolf interaction studies have indicated. Perhaps a compounding factor in that was that last year was a difficult winter, and it likely we do know that in difficult winters, wolf mortality is higher than in normal or easy winters.
And Mr. Merchant, you said wolf mortality. I believe you meant the deer mortality by wolf. Yeah, thank you. Any comment on that, Representative Fabian?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a couple of things. First, I'd like to address the statement that we made about the former TB zone. Living there, I'm intimately aware of what's actually going on, and there still are a number of restrictions on the producers in the area. So I know that we are designated TB-free in the state of Minnesota, but we also still have an ongoing issue with regards to that. So I would caution the use of the term former. The other thing that I was, I'm surprised, honestly, I'm surprised to see is the number of deer that have been taken by wolves in that area. And I'm curious to know, Dr. Meech, whom I have respect for, obviously, stated in the testimony last week something to the effect that a great number of the deer that are taken by wolves are the ones that are old and ill or something like that. I'd like to know the condition of the wolves, excuse me, of the deer at the time, if you have any records, and it doesn't have to be now. At the time that they were trapped, netted, and radio collared, I assume that these deer, you did some sort of sampling on them to find out what condition they were in, and that may be of interest to those of us who think that the wolves are preying on too many deer.
Mr. Merchant or Deputy Director, did you have any information on the health of the deer, or if it's something you can share with us later, you can just get it to us electronically? That sounds like they're nodding yes, so we'll look forward for that information electronically. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Merchant, along with that information about the health of the deer at the time of collaring, I'd also be curious about of the condition of the deer after they were killed. Did the wolves consume those deer completely or not?
Again, Mr. Merchant or Deputy Director, if you have some information, that would be good to know. My experience when I've come upon a deer kill or the remains of a deer that the wolves got through Representative Torkelson, it's kind of scary sight. There's not much left except literally the bones. So they're pretty good at what they do and very effective. Deputy Director, can you continue on to the moose? We'd like to give you about 5 minutes to talk about moose in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to. You have another handout titled Minnesota Moose Population Data. Just very quickly, I believe this question came up when we were talking about wolf and relationship to moose populations. As you know, we have a moose population in the northeast part of the state that's distinct from a moose population in the northwest part of the state. Following intensive research that was conducted in the late 1990s, trying to understand a decline in the moose population in the northwest part of the state, the conclusions from that study indicated that 76 radio collared moose followed from a period of 1995 to 2000 died of a variety of causes, including disease and parasitism as the leading causes. That accounted for 61% of the mortalities in those 76 moose. Predation, 7%. Vehicle collisions, 4%. Poaching, 3%. And unknown causes, 25%. Unknown causes is a category that we work very hard to minimize, but sometimes we just can't get to the moose quick enough to do a postmortem that would indicate actual cause. But for the northwest population in the late 90s, moose predation, moose and bear predation, that predation would also include potential bear predation on calves, was at a much lower level than disease and parasitism. For the northeast population, that population is undergoing declines, and we're watching it very closely. At this point, we know that there's high adult mortality, but we don't fully understand the causes. And cow pregnancy rates are normal, but calf survival is lower than we'd like to see. So with the adult mortality rates, that's the most significant driver on the decline in the moose population at this time. So we are conducting a number of studies to better understand that situation. If you go to the second page on that handout, it shows it shows causes of non-hunting moose mortality being in the range in a range that's higher for other northern moose populations in the continent. In this case, wolf predation accounts for a very low level of mortality cause. In fact, I'm having a hard time finding the slice. It looks like about 10%. So the situation in the Northeast is not clear at all to us or other research scientists that we're working with, but we are looking at causes of adult mortality. We're beginning a calf mortality study in the near future. We're looking at the relationship of habitat to moose populations. But we're working hard with colleagues in our state and other states to understand this so that we can reverse it if it's at all possible.
Thank you, Deputy Director. Do you anticipate, has the department made a decision about a hunting season in the fall of 2012 yet?
Mr. Chair, members, no, we have not. We are currently conducting our moose aerial survey at this time. Got a little bit of a late start this year due to lack of snow, but it will be that survey that will inform us as to whether or not, whether or not we will be hunting next fall or not.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Don Carlos, I'm curious, at the top of, on the front page, it says you talk about or adult moose, 76 of them. Are you saying in here that 76 adult moose were radio collared?
Director Don Carlos.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, during the course of the study that was conducted in the late 1990s, 76 moose were radio collared and tracked. At this time, I don't believe we have any moose that are radio collared in the Northwest.
Correct. Because, Director Don Carlos, there is a study ongoing in the Northeast with radio collared moose, I believe is funded by LCCMR, if I'm not mistaken. That's in place right now. Representative Fabian.
Yeah, I'm just curious to know what percentage of the moose that were radio collared were calves.
Director Don Carlos, if the puzzled look means you don't know, you can get that back. I didn't mean to embarrass you. I'm sorry.
No.
But you're welcome to get back if you don't have any information on that or aren't sure.
Mr. Chair, we do have some data from the monograph that was written on this study, and Mr. Merchant can answer that question.
Mr. Merchant.
Mr. Chair, members, and during that study, 14 calves were radio collared out of the total of 76.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's
thank you. And thank you for the information, the update on the deer. I'm sorry, Representative Hansen has a question. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we've previously in this committee received information, I think from Dr. Frelick, data relating to the movement of the conifer forest north as the transitional area changes. What is the long-term prognosis for moose related to climate change in our state?
Deputy Director Don Carlos.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's a very difficult question to answer. There's a lot of uncertainty about what's going on with the moose population. There could be a variety of factors affecting the decline that we're seeing. While we're looking at this, we're also considering potential impacts on the type of forests that occur in northeast Minnesota. So we can't answer that question at this time, and we may not be able to answer it for years.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask, do we have the brain worm in northern Minnesota that they have in Ontario? And then having an agriculture background, I realize when you pregnancy check cows, it involves a pretty in detailed palpation. I'm curious how you confirm pregnancy rates in moose.
Director Don Carlos.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, as far as confirming pregnancy in moose, I haven't been out in the field during these procedures, but there's two ways that it can be done. We do collect blood samples, and those can be assayed for hormone levels to determine pregnancy rates, and also a palpation could be done, but there's also actually a third way. There's field ultrasound equipment that's often used with big animals in the field. So I'm not sure which of those methods we're using, but I'm sure one or a combination. But perhaps we can talk about it after.
Thank you. Next, we'd like...
Mr. Chair...
I'm sorry, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other part of the question, do we have brainworm? Has that been identified?
Director Don Carlos.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we do have brainworm in moose. Some scientists feel that brainworm is a large contributor to mortality in moose. Others don't agree with that position. Most things regarding moose population dynamics impacts on the moose population. There's not necessarily agreement about. They're a large species, a large ungulate, and you would think we would know more collectively as a field about this species, but they're a very perplexing species. Just because they're big doesn't mean they're well understood. The position they occupy in their system is a very complicated and not well understood one. So they do have brainworm, but our staff are really questioning how much of an impact that has on the actual population.
Thank you. Director Don Carlos, if you could move through the rest of the Game and Fish Bill, that would be good. We would like to wrap up with this part of the presentation in about 15 minutes through the rest of the Game and Fish Bill, as we have a couple of bills that we're going to take discussion on. The O'Driscoll bill, Representative Fabian will be presenting that. Representative O'Driscoll has gone back to his district for family reasons. So, Director Don Carlos, if you could move ahead. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just have one question. One of the initiatives in this bill may spark more questions. And because it's one of the first initiatives on the fact sheet, my question is, should we pause and give that some time right at the beginning of this briefing, or should we wait until the end? And I can adjust, we can adjust either way.
You can go at your own pace. You make that decision. I'll let you handle it.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to invite one of my colleagues to the table then to help with that presentation on the Game and Fish Bill.
Go ahead. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dirk Peterson. I'm the fisheries chief for the DNR. And the first...
So we'll go ahead and begin with the briefing, Mr. Chair and committee members. The DNR's Game and Fish Bill this year, at this point in time, includes 12 initiatives. And we spent quite a bit of time last Thursday talking about the third initiative on the fact sheet. And that has to do with the wolf season. So we're going to give you a brief overview of the rest of the initiatives. The first initiative has to do with minnow importation. And
excuse me, Director. Members, just so we're all on the same page, the director is working off the Department of Natural Resources fact sheet, 2012 policy fact sheet, and that's what she's working off of. Go ahead, Director.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Sorry if I confused anyone. This initiative in regarding minnow importation basically eliminates two types of permits, an import for later export and an import for feeding of bait fish. This is an important issue because the minnows that we're importing into this state are coming from North Dakota and South Dakota, where there is Asian carp in river systems there. Minnesota is at high risk for inadvertent introduction of Asian carp into the state, and this initiative would reduce that risk significantly. Now I'd like to ask Fisheries Chief Dirk Peterson to go into a bit more detail, referring to a handout that was also distributed to you at the beginning of the meeting.
Welcome, Chief Peterson. Go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the committee. The handout is titled Importing Minnows into Minnesota for Later Export or Feeding of Hatchery Fish. And I think we're all highly sensitized at this time to the fact that Asian carp are a real threat to our native fish populations, as well as the multi-billion dollar recreational angling industry that we have in Minnesota. They also even represent a public health concern in the sense that we've all heard about people being hit by jumping carp that are large and can be harmful to people on an individual basis. And as you know, each of you have been engaged in full discussions about what sort of investments do we need to make to prevent the spread of these fish through barriers and other methods. And the section of, although the Division of Ecological and Water Resources is the lead on the policy procedures that we're undertaking, the Section of Fisheries Management and the Division of Fish and Wildlife are very active participants in preventing Asian carp and other non-native fish introductions into Minnesota. On the handout, you'll see a map there that's color-coded with different combinations of Asian carp and where they're found in Minnesota and the Dakotas. And we know that they're starting to move up the Mississippi, but in the last few years they've moved up the Missouri River to the Gavin's Point Dam in South Dakota, and they are now present in the Big Sioux, the Vermilion, and the St. James River in the Dakotas, and the St. James River all the way into North Dakota, where last year in 2011 a silver carp was sampled up in central North Dakota. These fish represent are close at our door here, and we've done an internal review of a number of our practices. One of the things that came up was the fact that we do issue about 9 to 10 permits per year from the clouded shaded area on the map where minnow harvest takes place, and then through permit we allow the import of minnows to be exported across the state to other states that allow the import, and then secondly to feed fish in private aquaculture venues in west central Minnesota. About 90,000 gallons come in that way. About 10,000 reside for feeding fish in permitted ponds. And one of the problems with this is that this is a large quantity of minnows. Although everyone is operating under permit as they should legally, the identification of small Asian carp can be very difficult. If you look at the back side of the fact sheet, you'll see some examples of fingerling bighead carp, fingerling grass carp, which looks a lot like a chub, fingerling bighead, and the fingerling European rud, which is a European carp, look very similar to golden shiners. So if you have a large load of minnows coming across the border, it may be difficult to sort out the handful of Asian carps that might be present from these watersheds in the Dakotas. So we are proposing that Minnesota already has very strong ban on importation of minnows into the state. And if you look at the distribution of silver or even European carps, it forms a nice horseshoe around the state. This prohibition of minnow importation has served this state well for 50 years and has kept a lot of these species out. We see this minnow harvest area in the Dakotas as a real risk to the future of our fishing in this state. And the legislation we're proposing would actually ban the importation of live minnows through this small permitting system that we've operated for about 15, 16 years. It would still allow the import to export, but we would propose that those containers be sealed at the border as they cross the state to other states like Wisconsin. And thirdly, we would only allow minnows to be fed to aquaculturally raised fish through local harvest. There could be some impacts to the operators that benefit from this practice. One is that we would not allow to offload fish in the state for aggregation for further export, which we allow now. That would no longer be allowed. It'd still be allowed to transport the minnows across the state in sealed containers, and then we would allow them to, or recommend that they purchase those fishes in state. Currently, the state harvests about 3.5 million pounds of minnows. About a third of those that are harvested in Minnesota are already exported to other states from Minnesota. So taking the 80 to 90,000 minnows that they're importing from the Dakotas and transferring that to hopefully purchase within the state, that would be about 2.4% of the minnows that are harvested in the state. That would be an adjustment the industry would have to make. That's the rationale for this. We see the importation of these minnows through these 9 or 10 permits that we issue, about 90,000 pounds each year, or gallons, is a way to significantly reduce the risk of Asian carp introduction into Minnesota. We think it would be prudent. There would be some challenges for the industry, but we believe that they could adjust to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Peterson, for your presentation. The minnow folks are not here today, so when this bill does come back, we will hear their reaction. I hope over the next few days you do meet with them and let them know how serious we're looking at this. We're going to talk tomorrow about spending tens of millions of dollars to control the importation, or the movement, I should say, excuse me, of Asian carp. And we're certainly not going to spend that kind of money if we're not doing some of the other things and tools available to us. One question I did have, Chief Peterson, do we allow the importation of walleye, fingerling, and fry if some of these minnow folks that are raising walleye, specifically some are even raising it for the state of Minnesota, could they move that operation into South Dakota, and then would we allow the importation of the walleye, or do we not allow that?
Mr. Chair, I believe currently they've maintained their brood stock from fish that we have originally provided here in Minnesota, and I believe that's how our statutes are set up. I'm guessing that we would probably be hesitant to import walleye from other states when we've got providers and growers in this state that can do that just as well.
Good. Thank you. Okay, I've got Representative Anderson and then Representative Purcell. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. You mentioned the carp have been found in the Dakotas up the James River. Is that actual fish or is it DNA?
Chief Peterson. Chair, Representative Anderson, those are actual fish that have been sampled. The silver carp that was found all the way into North Dakota was a specimen that was taken.
Chief Peterson, do they have fish passages on the dams on the Missouri River in South Dakota?
Mr. Chair, that I'm not exactly certain of, but at the most, many dams represent significant barriers to carp movement. And at this point, I believe the Gavin's Point Dam in South Dakota provides that. But the confluence with the Vermilion, the James, and the Big Sioux rivers do not have barriers for carp to move up through there. So,
thank you for that clarification. I've got Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification, if you would, please, on this sheet that's got the pictures on it. Thank you for those pictures. Those do look a lot like shiners we use for fishing. last paragraph on that back page, it talks about, and you've got a nice pie chart. You're talking about 3 million pounds, I'm rounding numbers here, and a million pounds, and then you've got 10,523 gallons, and it's all on the same pie chart. I just, what, you know, of course, the handles don't match there. And I'm wondering, I realize you know that. What do you use to convert gallons? Are you using the weight of water, or what are you using?
Mr.
Director
Chair,
Peterson.
Representative
or
Purcell.
Chief, excuse me.
We use about 8.3 pounds.
About gallon. Water?
Well, about water.
Okay.
Yeah. Fish tend to be neutrally buoyant, so.
Hey. Thank you. Representative Purcell, I'm glad we both know the weight of water. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, looking at that map with the South Dakota counties that are identified with a positive population of Asian carp, has the DNR done any sampling within those watersheds that are on the Minnesota side of the border?
Mr.
Chief
Chair,
Peterson.
Representative Hansen, we do routine surveys of all our waters, you know, whether they be streams, lakes, and ponds, and, you know, places like the Red River and the Minnesota River are important fisheries of the state. Our field crews do periodic, if not routine, sampling of those sites. So we're continually looking for new species that are native that we haven't seen before, but we're always keeping a very wary eye for new invaders.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, has the DNR done any eDNA sampling or testing in that? In those watersheds on the Minnesota side?
Chief Peters.
Chair, Representative Hansen, not in the Red or the Minnesota River watersheds. And once again, as I indicate, our Division of Ecological and Water Resources have been coordinating the eDNA sampling, and I'm assuming you're pretty familiar with the news reports that we've released on that around the St. Croix and the Minnesota River down in the Twin Cities as well as the Mississippi.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And finally, what's the level of cooperation with the South Dakota Departments of Natural Resources or Iowa, North Dakota? I mean, are you meeting on these issues? Is there shared evaluation? What's happening with our surrounding states?
Chief Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we do annual meetings with our counterparts in any of our border states as well as the province of Ontario. And in our August meeting with South Dakota folks, we shared a lot of this information and our concerns with them. Fortunately, Minnesota is much advanced in its understanding and management of aquatic invasive species, even though they still remain very problematic for us. Our neighboring states don't have the level of protection in their statutory authority that we do, although recently in this last session, I believe the South Dakota legislature is now starting to designate infested waters and limiting harvest of bait fish from waters that have been identified as infested. So there are improvements there, but they lag behind us in our management, but we do meet with them each year and talk about these issues.
Thank you. Deputy Director Don Carlos, I'm thinking if you could, we've got the fact sheet and the different things that will be included in the Game and Fish Bill after we actually get the bill and Representative Hackbart gets it introduced, but could you just touch on for in a couple minutes what you see as anything of significant change or controversy so that members will have it on their radar screen when it comes back?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. I would suggest that the following sections are more than housekeeping aspects of a policy bill, and they would include it's the sixth initiative, starting with sections 8 and 27 regarding deer baiting and big game license revocation. This initiative follows a court case last year where it became clear that we needed to better clarify baiting definitions related to normal agricultural practices. And in this initiative, we're proposing that baiting be defined as placing, exposing, depositing, distributing, or scattering bait capable of attracting deer. liquid scents, salts, and minerals would not be considered bait if they do not contain liquid or solid food ingredients. And then finally, agricultural crops from normal farming would not be considered a bait unless they have been removed from the field, reintroduced, and concentrated in an area where people are hunting. So this is an initiative that I think that there will be a lot of interest in. This is important for us because we do need to clarify these statutes when our conservation enforcement officers are monitoring activity. For further discussion on this, when this comes up again, when Representative Hackbarth introduces the bill, I'd suggest that we be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith to also talk about this issue. Another initiative that I think will draw interest from amongst yourselves and stakeholders is the eighth initiative on the front of the page. It's at the very bottom. It's starting Section 23 pertaining to blaze orange requirements for small game hunting. This is an initiative that we're proposing that corrects the situation that was offered to us by a journalist last fall in an article and basically would amend the current blaze orange requirements for small games hunting, providing an exception so that archery deer hunters may be able to take small game without wearing blaze orange if they're in a stationary position. Again, this may have safety concerns around it, and it may be of interest to you as well. On page two of the handout, there's two initiatives that I'd like to bring to your attention. Well, actually, all four of these initiatives, I think, will draw interest from you. But going to the second initiative, starting with Section 26 regarding special hunts for physically disabled hunters, this initiative would allow physically disabled hunters to use a swivel or a mechanical or electronic device to hold or discharge a firearm or bow while hunting if they are present at the site. Need was brought to our attention last fall by a group that was helping with a turkey physically disabled hunt, and we have crafted language and reviewed it with Capable Partners members, and the Game and Fish Bill reflects that language that that we have vetted with the Capable Partners group. The next initiative, pertaining to Section 34 regarding beaver control, I know that this is of interest, especially in the northwest part of the state, and we've had discussions with Representative Fabian and others about these statutes. We feel that the proposal that we're making would clarify the statutes so that it is clear that local government units can apply for beaver removal permits from the DNR to remove beavers that are causing damage to roads or silviculture projects on land that is owned or managed by that local government unit. We're currently issuing permits for those situations. Our enforcement division is issuing those permits, but there seems to be confusion, and we feel that the statute language that we're proposing makes it very clear that local governments can apply for those permits. And then finally, a little bit different, and that you may hear about. I don't think that this will be controversial. We don't think it will be controversial. But the final initiative, Section 38, would allow taking of waterfowl in open waters designated by the commissioner by rule. Specifically, this pertains to a suggestion that we most recently heard in the waterfowl focus groups that the commissioner hosted last spring and summer about hunting waterfowl on open water where a hunter can't be concealed by natural vegetation as specified in statute. There is interest in hunting on big water, Lake Superior and other large lakes in the state, and this initiative would allow us to make this offering within the federal migratory hunting framework and would allow more compatibility with adjoining states and provinces that do allow this. So those would be, I think, the initiatives that may be of most interest to yourselves and stakeholders.
Well, thank you. And members, if you have additional game and fish issues, I'd encourage you to work with Representative Hackbart as the bill comes forward and additional initiatives. Some of these are going to be controversial. The last one specifically, I think, will allow hunters to hunt out of sink boxes. We're one of the few states that don't potentially allow that. That's a hunter below the surface of the water. Something those of us that have always duck hunted, Minnesota was a state I was real surprised to hear that most other states do allow this. We're one of few, but some of this is controversial, and we like the idea of allowing more flexibility for the taking of beaver. So as we go forward, I think we'll have these issues back before us. So thank you for this presentation. It does set us up to move this forward as we come with a real busy agenda. Members, next, Representative Fabian is going to present House File 1923 and what's involved in that bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Fabian, I believe you've got a couple of folks that have traveled down maybe from Representative O'Driscoll's district with you, so if they want to come forward at the same time to the presenter's table, that would be good. Members, it's House File 1923, and it is in your packet. Representative Fabian, if you could present the gist of the bill, that would be good. And then the folks at the testifier table, if you just remember to say who you are and who you represent when you do get a chance to speak, that would be good, and talk directly into the mic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm presenting this bill today for Representative O'Driscoll. This is House File 1923, and ironically, this situation was brought to my attention a couple of weeks ago by the city of Thief River Falls. The mayor contacted me and had concerns about the implementation of the conservation rate structure, and he made mention of the fact that in the turkey processing plant that they have in Thief River Falls, if these rates go into effect, he said that their water bill could be increased by as much as $40,000 in 1 year because of that. I've also had conversations. One of the hospitals that's in my district is a very large water user just because of the nature of their business. That water use is going to increase in the near future because they are putting a kidney dialysis operation into effect. So I'm concerned about the additional cost to our local businesses and so forth. Also, with regards to the turkey processing plant, you could make the argument that there is one arm of the government that is telling them that they have to meet certain sanitary standards within their facility, and that requires the use of a great deal of water. But then we also have another branch of government telling them that they're possibly using too much. So there's a conflict there. At this time, what I would like to do is kind of turn the testimony, you might say, over to Bill Scholz. Good German name. He's the Public Works Director in Sartell, and Patty Gartland, the Sartell Administrator, and I think that they have some comments for the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. If you could introduce yourselves for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Patty Gartland. I am the Sartell City Administrator. I've served in this capacity for 10 years, and previous to this was the planning director in St. Cloud for 13 years. We appreciate your time and consideration of this legislation. It's our request, respectful request of you, that you repeal this mandate requiring conservation rate structure as determined by the DNR. And it's our suggestion that conservation measures, including pricing, are better determined on a local level. We, as a public water supplier, are very well motivated and very committed to protecting both the quantity and the quality of that public water supply. It's clearly in our vested interest. If we don't have a viable water supply, it is certainly to the detriment of our communities. So we are very much proponents for protecting and preserving both the quantity and the quality of that supply. We take that responsibility very seriously. We believe, though, that tiered pricing, or the conservation rate structure pricing, can be very punitive, and punitive to segments of our communities that we don't want to be punitive to, in particular our businesses and our apartment developments. Our business community and our apartment sectors are our largest property taxpayers. They are paying a significant share of the public bill cost for providing those public services. They also tend to be our largest users of water supply. So when we talk about implementing a conservation rate structure that will place them at a higher rate structure because they inherently tend to be higher consumers, it is going to drive their costs up. We believe if it's a jeopardy to our businesses, it's a jeopardy to jobs. It's a jeopardy to both current jobs and those jobs that we're trying to create. We are very concerned about creating a scenario that encourages or creates greater risk for business to choose to not locate in our community, to instead escape the regulation and the higher pricing structure represented from our public water supply, go outside our borders and develop right outside our borders, be able to install their own private well system, with and escape both the pricing and the regulatory structure that they have in our municipal water system. We think that's counterproductive to both what we hope to accomplish as a community and to what the state is hoping to facilitate. With that, I think I'll turn it over to my colleague, and he'll make it known that he's not with Sartell, but a neighboring community.
Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Bill Schlunz. I am the public works director for the city of Wade Park. We are neighboring with Sartell in the St. Cloud metro area. I come to you today from the public utility side of managing a system. Ms. Gartland did explain most of the points I want to talk about today, but one of them I wanted to explain a little bit further is when you manage a utility system, there are fixed costs to running that system. Yes, we pump water out of the ground, we have to treat it, we have to pump it back up into the water towers and to maintain that system. No matter what happens with your utility system, you do need upgrades, you need to do expansions, O&M, basically operations and maintenance. And most utility systems, those costs are fixed year to year. They very rarely fluctuate no matter what happens. The big driving cost is when systems are mandated to do improvements to their system, to the treatment facilities, like Representative Fabian was talking about. So as cities and utilities increase and build and upgrade their systems, their bond payments are set. They're set for anywhere from 5 to 20 years, depending on which system and what rate structure they came up with. So with that being said, there's a fixed cost that basically, what it's easy math. Whatever we pump out or what the consumer uses, you divide that basically into the gallons or your dollars that you need to have to break even. And that's how basic math comes out to get your rate. If you implore a tiered rate system, what you're going to see is, let me speak to this. single-family units right now do a very good job out there of conserving their own water. What's going to happen, as Ms. Gartland explained, that your bigger users, your apartment buildings, and your businesses will reduce their costs or their consumption. Ultimately, what that will do is raise the rates, because you have less water to divide into your overall cost. It's going to drive your rates up. This will go on year after year after year. It'll never stop. And ultimately, what happens is that those costs will be pushed back onto the single-family user, the single property taxpayer. And they look at it both ways. They look at it as more of a tax, too. Even though it's a user fee, they're paying for it. But what you're going to see is those costs keep going up and up and up, and your single-family residential units will be bearing most of those costs. I would implore you to just consider to leave this in local control, not a mandate from the legislation side. Cities do a great job right now. We, in fact, our city increased our rates less last year, and we saw a decrease. Obviously, there was a lot of rainfall this year, but we did see it from the consumption side also, because the rates went up. And just let it be there, and let each city choose which rate structure they wanted to use, if it be at a flat rate or a tiered rate or whatever that is. Let them choose. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schlunz. Questions? Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll speak as loud as I can. One of the reasons, of course, that this whole thing went in was because we know that in Minnesota we may not have the quantity of water for future residents that we would want them to have. I know that in Thief River Falls, for example, they've never done a geologic atlas, but I don't know about Sartell or Waite Park. Have geologic atlases been done for your area?
Testifiers either. Mr. Schlunz?
Mr. Chair and the representative, I'm not aware of that. I mean, we can find out and get back to you on that, but I'm not aware that that's been done yet.
Representative Wagenius, we were going to hear from the DNR, so maybe they could answer that. I've got both the DNR on this issue and Mr. Bocic both wanted to testify. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, but I would have hoped that local units of government would have known whether they have geologic atlases done in their area, because that's what tells you if you really do have a large quantity of water or not. And to not know that kind of basic fact is, folks should know that. One of the things we haven't done as a group is funded enough geologic atlases to cover the whole state. And we have in some areas and we haven't in other areas. It seems to me that the first thing you should be asking us for is to fund a geologic atlas for your area before you say that we have plenty of water and we know how to manage it. So that, I'll wait then for DNR.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a question for either of the testifiers. It seems that you're looking to basically repeal this conservation rate structure. And as alluded to, that there are fixed costs running utility. So if the cost structure goes down for some of the largest users, who is going to pick up that additional differential in maintaining and just keeping the utility functioning, assuming that we're dealing with a static number of dollars here, just in this scenario, who's picking up that cost?
Ms. Gartland or Mr. Schlunz?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representative, I would suggest to you that it's a shift. The conservation rate structure is intended to create a higher rate for higher capacity or higher volume users. As a result, they will pay more, but then the idea is that incents them to do things to consume less, assuming that they can. To the extent that they cannot, they simply are going to pay more. And I think the fact that you have a business that may consume five times the amount of water as a necessary part of their operation, they're already motivated, regardless of what that rate is, to reduce it. If they've reduced it as much as they can, it is going to drive their cost up. To the extent that they are able to reduce it, then it's going to, as Mr. Schlund said earlier, indicated, it'll push that over onto the lower volume users. So it really, I think, is at the heart of why we think it's most appropriate to be addressed on a local level. In the city of Sartell, we went through an exhaustive process of siting a new water treatment plant. We did that full investigation to make sure where we were, the aquifer we were tapping, had that adequate supply. I can't answer whether or not there's a geological atlas that went with that, but I know that there was exhaustive investment to make sure where we were doing the $12 million investment in a new water treatment plant was going to be sufficient to meet the long-term needs of our area.
Representative Paul, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I didn't quite get the answer to my question there, but if I'll try to rephrase it. So if the cost for the water usage of the large users goes down, and when you say the lower users or lower usage users would go up, that means that would be homeowners and small businesses, and so we're asking them to pay more. Is that just a simple yes to that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Additional question? Thank you. The DNR or and or then we'll have Mr. Botzik after the DNR. Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Representative Wagenius, the geological atlas, I'd like to address that. I had conversations yesterday leading up to this. I talked to two city mayors and also a city administrator, not from Thief River Falls, any of them. And quite frankly, when I asked them about the conservation rate structure, they don't even know about that, that it's coming January 1st of 2013. So there has been a lack of communication going out to some of these communities for whatever reason. These people don't know about it. And with regards, you mentioned Thief River Falls. I'm certain that they get their water from the Red Lake River at this time, and I realize things can change, but the Red Lake is at close to an all-time high, and they are draining it down, and there is an ample supply of water coming into Thief River Falls at this time. I think it's best left to the local governments to make the best decisions, working with their local people and their local businesses as to what's best for them. Thank you.
Thank you. If you could identify yourself for the records and give your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Luthi. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Ecological and Water Resources of the Department of Natural Resources. I appreciate the concerns that you heard on this bill. The language in this law could be improved. There are issues here that are causing concerns, and I think that the Department of Natural Resources, as well as our other sister agencies, Department of Health and Pollution Control Agency and others who help manage the state's water supply, would be willing to work with the communities that are having concerns with the conservation rate structure. I think that there is an important sense here is that we don't want to lose the conservation rate structure because there's some inherent problems with potentially on pricing of the system. It is important to manage water supply for the state. We have some challenges with the water supply of the state in terms of quantity or quality. In regards to Representative's discussion here, the Red Lake River may be high, but I was attended part of the recent flood task force meeting to look at floods for Minnesota and the conversations about drought. And in fact, the southern third and the northeast part of the state are in severe drought conditions at this time of year, which is not normal, as well as most of the rest of the state is in what's called moderate drought conditions. And so as we look at water supply management, we have to look at the bigger picture. As we look at our aquifers, we need to look at outside of the area of where you put in your wells and what is the short-term supply, which is what communities are attempting to address, to also look at where does that water come from a longer period of time so that it is there, that the quantity and the quality are managed so that we can make sustainable decisions about how we make sure that we have enough to go around for future generations. part of the challenge before this law was in place was that there was no conservation rate structure. It was called increasing block rate, and so the more you used, the cheaper your price. That's not presenting the right message as we look at potential supply limits in either quantity or in quality, and so we don't want to see this law thrown out. We certainly can see some opportunity to improve it so conservation works better with the communities. So I think I'll stop there and answer additional questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Luthi. I appreciate your testimony, and the one thing I heard from you was that our state is wide and vast and very different, and if we could manage at a local level, that would make a lot of sense. So I think your point that the community of Thief River may be different than the community of Minneapolis, and if they can manage their resources at a local level, there's some advantage to that, and it's hard for us as a state to tell every city how they should be doing things when they're so different, so maybe it makes more sense for us to get back and let some local people do their thing that they have the ability to do. If I'm not mistaken, there's communities, for instance, Woodbury has already put this in place. In there, it's mostly a residential situation where people just don't get it. They don't need to run their sprinkler system every day that they possibly can, that their lawns will actually do better if they watered less. And so the city has taken it upon themselves, which they're empowered to do, to deal with that issue. And maybe Sartell or Thief River want to do it a little different. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the repealer on the bill, and it indicates that a public water supplier serving more than 1,000 people in the metropolitan area shall use a conservation rate structure by January 1st, 2010. So has this law already been implemented in the metro area?
Mr. Luthi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, this law has been implemented in approximately half of the communities. Not everybody is required to do it immediately, but it also is hinged on when they would ask for a permit amendment or a new well for supply, and so not all of them got it done, but more than half have already instituted it, and the concerns have been not significant that we have heard of in terms of how they manage it.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you'd be able to have real cost data, not potential anecdotal data, but real cost data of what it's cost in the metropolitan area for communities to achieve the water conservation rate.
Mr. Luthi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I don't know that we track the actual costs of local communities because, as the testimony has been, is that that is the best place to manage how the costs are handed out and how they manage their supply. And so communities make decisions about how to do the rate structure. The law just requires that they do a conservation rate structure. The Department of Natural Resources does not dictate how they do that or what the costs will be. That is partly the really actually in the bailiwick of the communities and the water suppliers to say, how do we make this work? We're attempting to encourage conservation. They know their customers and their users and the efficiencies that they have. We want them to be involved in figuring that part out. We don't want to be in the middle of that, but we want to make sure that we are having conservation as an incentive, because some of the testimony here is that the more we use, the lower it as can be for other people, but if we're using more and the supplies become limited, we end up with some challenges. And so it is a partnership between the local units of government. We can keep track and help people understand what the water supplies are for the state that are much bigger than generally the area that they're serving, because it's a smaller community and we're looking at a larger landscape on where the water gets in, how much is there when it rains, how much is recharged in the groundwater system to make sure that there's sustainable supplies. And so it's a partnership, and that local control is very essential.
Representative Hansen.
So, Mr. Chair, there is local control for local creativity on how to achieve the goal. I think the reason why we have a statewide standard and not just a metro standard, but a statewide standard, is that the water that falls on Sartell or the water that's under Thief River Falls doesn't stay there. It moves. And water is an overall resource. So having the statewide goal and providing for the local creativity to achieve that goal gives the local units of government the ability to do that. We don't want to have a community be a water hog upstream from us or up gradient from us with groundwater. That's the potential that we could have with pure local control. So the need is there there are areas of the state that are groundwater flush, but there are areas that are not. And as we start to develop into those areas where there's not as much potential for groundwater, you're going to have water demands like there are in the western states. So I hope this bill does not, I hope this bill doesn't go where it's going. We don't have to have repeal of this.
Representative Knute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen covered a fair bit of what I wanted to cover. And it's just, I think, drawing members' attention to the repealer. It says they must have a conservation rate structure, which could include block rates, seasonal rates, time of use rates, individualized goal rates, or excess use rates. So, and it seems like you could even, working with some of your biggest users, figure out different conservation structures that might work better for them. And it would seem to me to provide that flexibility in this law. And so I would just encourage us to think about, does the state care about water conservation in our water rates? And I would venture to say that I think the state does care, especially as we have increasing uncertainty in our rainfall and our snowfall, and we may go into more drought times or flood times, but have less certainty overall. So I would reiterate what Representative Hansen said in the testifier, and I have heard one concern about this, and I just wanted to ask the testifier of his interpretation. I represent four different manufactured home parks, and their concern is that the way this is written, it says the rate structure must consider each residential unit as an individual user in multifamily dwellings, and that clearly is apartments, but it seems like there's some concern that it might not apply in manufactured home parks, and overall, manufactured home parks may use a significant amount if they have a couple hundred to 300 houses. And is your interpretation of this that manufactured home parks would be covered under that multifamily dwellings, or does it need a tweak in the law to make sure that those types of homes are not impacted differently than other residential units?
Mr. Luthy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not as familiar with exactly how that is. I think that in general we look to the community to justify what makes sense to them and how they will accomplish this goal. And if they need some flexibility for multifamily dwellings or if they need some flexibility for their industrial parks, I think that, again, as the testifiers, they are the ones who know the most about this and how it will work. I guess, again, we're encouraging conservation. If they come with a plan, we're not looking over in that level of detail to say how are they dealing with those particular uses. Our overall goal is saying how do we managing that so that we're overall trying to reduce the use or the overuse of water and encourage the conservation side. And so we will look at each plan, figure out how to do that. In the turkey supply thing, there's certainly some flexibility on how they do their rate structures, and they would have the ability to say if the turkey plant's going to get a $40,000 bill, what technologies are there available, what can they do to figure out how to manage that, and if that doesn't make sense, they can make a suggestion or draft their ordinances or controls to do that. We'll review it with them, talk about it, and see what's reasonable.
Thank you. Representative Qualm, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a bill trying to address this and some other issues, and if other representatives want to give input, I'm very open to working on covering this because they're often an overlooked area of our state.
And I would encourage all members to work with Representative O'Driscoll and Representative Fabian as this moves forward and comes back. If you've got ideas on addressing some of the concerns that you've expressed here, I would hope that you'll work with him and see if we can find a solution. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the crux of this issue is whether conservation is necessary or not. I'm not sure what means local units of government would have to encourage conservation other than manipulation of pricing, of a price structure. But I am pretty sure that if it turned out that we actually did need to conserve water resources because they're not infinite, and we're using them at a faster rate than they're being replenished, that ultimately the result would be that when we ran up against the actual constraints in supply, the price would go up. So maybe the question is, do we want to try to deal with that before that actually happens, or wait until it happens?
Thank you. Mr. Botzek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief, but Gary Botzek, Minnesota Conservation Federation, and we're proud to have the word conservation in our title. Many of the things that I was going to say have been addressed by the last couple questions here, but I did want to bring up two things. One, former Representative Paul Gartner did send an email out. I think most of you have seen it. I think he raises some very interesting points as far as the history. 2008, this legislation passed. I believe it was the same year, pretty close, that the Great Lakes Compact was also passed. Representative Tom Huntley brought through this very committee a very progressive protection, conservation of Lake Superior water, which is the largest freshwater lake in the world. Wouldn't it be apropos or embarrassing if we have to start tapping Lake Superior water for Minnesota? We keep talking or hearing about people wanting to sell it or tap it for Arizona or south, you know, and we're dealing with drought situations in Minnesota now, too, not just Texas and Oklahoma. So wouldn't it be ironic with Minnesota, with one of the, probably the largest amount of fresh water, but it's not being replaced, as Representative Hilty mentioned. So we need to protect that. The compact calls for conservation techniques and strategies to be implemented statewide by each of the states. Minnesota was the first state to join that compact, and seven or eight other states have done so. And Congress has passed it. I think all but one province in, that's on the Great Lakes in Canada have joined. And that is very, and it's ironically, that compact language is codified in 103G 801. So it's in the same statute, water statute, as the language you're looking at today. So let's be careful. Take a look at Gartner's memo. I think it lays it out very well. And then take a look at the compact language, because we want to think of the money we're spending on clean water as part of the legacy to clean up water, but we have to be interested and concerned about quantity as well as quality, and that was alluded to earlier. And so let's not overdo it here. I agree with what DNR just said. Like, we have to work with Thief River and Wake Park and Sartell to solve their problems, but the metro cities, half of them are in place. Let's not stop, or let's not retreat. Let's try to move forward. So with that, Mr. Chairman, the conservation community and the environment community will work with the authors as this bill progresses.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Botzek? Representative Draskowski, you want to move the minutes from our previous meeting?
I will. I read them thoroughly, okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Unfortunately, Representative Hackbarton, I believe you were able to let your testifiers know we weren't able to get to your two snowmobile bills. The deputy registers had driven in from a little ways away, but they said they will come back again. So, members, with that, the meeting's adjourned.